This is the Center for Strategic and International Studies weekly podcast, Smart Women, Smart Power. It's made possible by Citigroup. Here's your host, Nina Easton, senior editor and Washington columnist, Fortune Magazine, chair, Fortune Most Powerful Women International, and senior associate at CSIS.
Welcome to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. I'm Nina Easton, and we're coming to you from CSIS in Washington. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. You can find me at Nina Easton, all one word, and our Smart Women, Smart Power handle is at Smart Women, also all one word. Today, we're talking about money, but not just any money, mobile money, and how it will disrupt those staid old ways we've been using to try to reduce global poverty. Its use is growing rapidly, particularly in emerging markets. What is mobile money and why it's important to U.S. foreign policy? And we're even going to go beyond that today. We're going to talk about just disrupting foreign aid, U.S. foreign aid, to make it work better. Joining me with the answers is Maura O'Neill, an entrepreneur. Actually, she's a serial entrepreneur, having started four companies. She's worked extensively in the area of digital finance. You should also know she was the former chief innovation officer at USAID. I don't mean to intimidate all of you out there, but she does have, as she puts it, a couple of MBAs from Berkeley and Columbia, and a PhD in biology, psychology, and business decisions. She grew up in Silicon Valley. Basically, her enemy in life is narrow thinking. Maura, let's start with that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that what people don't understand is that we're actually hardwired to be narrow-minded. You know, we have trouble with that a lot of the time, but I have to decide immediately in milliseconds whether you're an enemy or whether you're a friend. And so if you remember seeing Dustin Hoffman in The Rain Man, he was somebody who could consume a lot of information but couldn't process it. So narrow-mindedness in many ways is our friend, but the problem is it makes us very narrow-minded with respect to solutions. And as the world changes, as circumstances change, as we need to rethink things like homosexuality or racism, we default to old terrible ideas. And so the idea is that I'm a narrow-mindedness buster, and that's really what innovation is. And if you look at the history of the country, our country was a disruptor. And what we've built on, and 40% of our economy, is that innovation engine. And that's why we are the envy economically, historically, of the rest of the world.
So 40% of our economy is dedicated to innovative.
Yeah, 40% of our economy is small businesses. 90% of the people in the US work for companies of less than 20, and 80% less than 10. So Starbucks and Microsoft were once a little company. So that's the engine, the innovation engine. Now some of those die and some of those go on to be the Fortune 500s. Yeah. And so that's what we do better than the rest of the world, is we have this little engine, this innovation engine, right, in small businesses, some of which grow up to be globally important companies.
Now, these days, you're bringing those kinds of ideas and teaching to my alma mater, UC Berkeley,
right,
and you're teaching there. But you recently were chief innovation officer at USAID, the first one, first chief innovation officer. And you decided to bring disruption to foreign aid, USAID, of course, being our biggest donor, as it were, of U.S. dollars to developing countries and so forth, and disaster relief and beyond. But it's been criticized a lot over the years for not being all that effective. You tried to address that. How?
Well, what we knew was when USAID started, of all the money, private money going into countries globally, about 90% of it came from aid organizations like AID. It's sort of stunning to think that that included remittances, investment, everything. Today, that's less than 10%. And yet, a lot of the ways that AID were honorable and made sense 20 or 30 years ago need to be disruptive. We need to be relentless about getting outcomes faster, cheaper, and more sustainable.
With private money.
with private money, with others' donors' money, with countries themselves' money. You know, all of us in the U.S. didn't decide we were going to care about clean water. They set up municipal water districts and essentially taxed us for clean water.
Yeah.
So if we don't figure out some of these strategies in other countries, we'll be playing for everybody's clean water globally till our grandchildren. And
right.
that just doesn't make any sense. Didn't work for us, isn't going to work for the rest of the world.
And you use Korea as an example.
Yes. So when AID started, South Korea was its first country that we aided. At the time, South Korea had lower per capita income than sub-Sahara Africa.
It's and what year are we talking?
So late 50s,
okay.
Early 60s. And today, of course, it's a powerhouse. So what?
And a donor.
And a donor. So what President Obama and at the time Secretary Clinton said, let's imagine the conditions where aid is no longer needed. And I translate that into, let's figure out how to create more South Koreas and less North Koreas.
So one of the big disruptors that you see in making this happen is mobile money. Describe
exactly.
that. Why?
Okay. So first of all, it's a good idea to tell people what mobile money is. So if you think about your credit card or your direct deposit account at your bank, if you put those all on a telephone, that's essentially what mobile money is. So if you could store your money and spend your money and people could give you money on your mobile phone, that's what mobile money is. And what you need is a network not dissimilar to what we have with credit cards, where you get paid into that account, your salary, for example, but also you can go to the local vendor or kiosk or bodega and actually buy something with it. I believe that mobile money has the ability to be the most important technology in terms of lifting people out of poverty that we've ever seen.
More important than
the Green Revolution. So we are enormously proud of the innovations that we made to save millions and millions of people, primarily in Asia, with new strains of wheat and corn and others. And ultimately, when the story is written, I believe mobile money will have facilitated more people coming out of extreme poverty than the Green Revolution.
Explain that step by step. How does that work?
So it happens on a number of levels. You know, what we want is people to, we wanted them to give money in order to have the economy working. So the first week that Administrator Raj Shah and I arrived at AID was the Haiti earthquake, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That was the largest urban disaster in modern history. It actually was the largest we know of. We just say modern history.
Mm-hmm.
And so the traditional aid way would be to give food aid. How do the stores actually get up and running? If why would you pay for food if somebody's going to give it?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm running that local store, you have just in the process destroyed my business.
Mm-hmm.
So traditional aid, oftentimes in humanitarian, will actually cause economies to be slower to come back. What we did in Haiti was give people vouchers so they could go to the local store with that and buy the products that were on the shelf, or at least encourage that shop owner to buy more. That's an example, if you magnify that globally, of if you enable an economy to actually work in the traditional capitalist way, people will actually get out of poverty.
So then how does mobile phones, essentially banking by mobile phones is what you're talking about,
right?
Too, when you talk about mobile money,
right?
Beyond vouchers. So how does that work?
So what it works is that you either earn wages and are paid in mobile money. So for example, USAID through Catholic Relief Services hired people to get rid of the rubble after the earthquake. Okay, they got paid, a number of them, in mobile money. It reduced the overhead costs by 60% at some of the most difficult places, because you can imagine it's really expensive to bring cash every place. We know
not to mention enticing corruption.
Exactly, corruption, theft, all sorts of things, and so it helps just on reducing administrative costs. But now you've got money stored in your wallet, and you need building supplies because your house has collapsed, you can go to the local building supply and you can actually pay for it with money on your phone. And so what you do is you transfer it. You go there and say, I'm going to transfer this to you, and you have a PIN code. You put in that PIN code and it accepts that money. So long as you keep your four-digit PIN code private, we can have a secure transaction.
So how does that help in terms of helping people out of poverty? I mean, is it because they don't have access to banking accounts and credit cards and you're bypassing that whole system?
So 2 billion people in the world have mobile phones that don't have bank accounts. So they can't really participate.
So 2 billion people have mobile phones, but they don't have bank accounts.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So think about, you have nowhere to store your money. You have no way to make small payments on insurance for your crop. Now you can do that. So if your crop fails before, you're all of a sudden was doing okay, and now because of a bad year, a drought, you're pushed into poverty, extreme poverty for the next year or two. If you were able to buy an insurance policy for which you could pay for that amount on your mobile phone with your savings account, then what you would do at that year that the drought happened, and this is absolutely happening, there's 123 million people that are using mobile insurance or mobile credit and savings globally right now already. You are basically don't drop into extreme poverty.
So do you need a savings account at root, or is the savings account on your mobile?
The savings account's in your mobile. You just store your money there.
Because you've been paid by mobile.
Exactly.
When you sell your crops, it goes into that savings account.
Right, it goes into your account. You can buy you now don't have to just buy your inputs, your fertilizer, your seed from the local vendor that's coming into your town. You can use your mobile phone to find out, is there somebody cheaper that's maybe 10 miles away? Hmm. You consummate that transaction over the phone using mobile money.
Right.
And then it's worth it for you to go pick that up, or maybe that vendor will actually deliver it. So instead of being beholden to the money lenders, mm-hmm. which often can charge 150% interest, or the input dealers for cement or for seeds or for fertilizer, you now have been empowered by your mobile phone and by an e-commerce system to all of a sudden be able to get much better prices.
So it's like cleaned up capitalism.
It is. So when Haiti happened, what people didn't realize is that people had 90% of their assets held in cash. So we looked at all those buildings collapse, but we didn't realize they lost all their money at the same time.
Hmm.
So about a month after, we went down to talk to them, and this is where donors can be enormously helpful. So I think it's really important that the moral of this story is not that foreign aid should go away. Foreign aid should just change to be much more leveraged and to enable these kinds of systemic changes. So we met with the mobile operators, we met with the central bank, and we said, how do we basically, as close to overnight, stand up a mobile money system? Not one that the donors run, but the banks and the mobile operators do. So USAID and the Gates Foundation put together multi-million dollar incentives for the first mobile operator to do mobile money, and then for a series of transactions. So about 2 years after we started, I went back down to announce that 5 million transactions had been done on mobile money.
Yeah, so bring us down to the ground on Haiti. How is that operating in terms of your average person, and was there resistance among the population at first? There or elsewhere?
You know, where there's resistance is where the banking industry has failed in the past. So if people, like in Afghanistan, people had their assets in Kabul Bank, it failed. It makes people nervous to use a new financial system. They want to know, is it trustworthy? Is it insured, et cetera?
Is it insured? Is their money insured?
In most cases, the central bank, what is our equivalent of the Federal Reserve in each country, has required that those mobile operators or their banks hold that money in an escrow account.
Okay.
100% of the money in an escrow account.
Okay.
So it isn't like your traditional banks where they take deposits and then they lend it out. Right. On mobile money, they actually can't touch this money.
So you're listening to the Smart Women Smart Power podcast. I'm Nina Easton, and my guest today is serial entrepreneur Maura O'Neill, who, by the way, was the first chief innovation officer at USAID. And we're talking about the growth of mobile money and other disruptors to foreign aid and helping the global poor. Follow me on Twitter at Nina Easton, and you can follow us on Twitter at Smart Women. You can also follow Maura at Maura L. O'Neill, and I'm going to spell that for you, at Maura, M-A-U-R-A, L, capital L, O-N-E-I-L-L, Maura L. O'Neill. Well, thanks for being with us. Can you give us some, stepping outside Haiti, can you give us some on-the-ground examples of where you've actually seen, if this is such a disruptor to poverty rates, where you've actually seen this change a community?
Right. So let's take an issue like Afghanistan. Many of the police and military don't show up to work every day, and that's a problem in terms of security in the country, in part because they're walking to get their paychecks or to bring their family money, and there's also some sticky hands on that money that gets to them. So there was Roshan, which is the mobile operator there, did a pilot where they paid the police officers in mobile money rather than in cash. And on average, those police officers were getting 30% more. They thought the mobile phone companies actually gave them a raise. Instead,
wow.
That's how much we figured out was being skimmed by these trusted advisors
wow.
taking suitcases with of cash. What I like to say is those suitcases had a lot of holes in them.
Yes, yeah.
And so you think about what that 30% does.
That's a lot of money.
Family. It's a huge amount of money. Same with teachers. So. And so we think that in terms of salary payments, in terms of social welfare payments, it's going to make a huge difference.
There'll be more money inside the formal, non-corrupt economy.
Exactly, exactly. So one of the things that Modi has announced in India is
the Prime
Minister Modi has announced that he wants to put $65 billion worth of social welfare payments in mobile money, on digital mm-hmm. of some sort, primarily mobile money. You can imagine the impact of getting that money directly to somebody who is under extreme poverty, as opposed to all the process and the bureaucrats and the banks and the sticky fingers that go along the way. So that's what I mean. It also allows entrepreneurs to set up small businesses. So when I was in Western Kenya, there was this guy who had grown up terribly poor in a slum, and he lived just about 30 miles away from a city in Western Kenya. He used to buy cement in bulk, and then he used to package it in smaller amounts that the people in his town could do. So he could do that with mobile money, and he wouldn't have to be worrying about the security issues, about carrying a lot of cash, paying his vendors. He didn't have to put that money out. He could just transfer it on that account. So that's an example. If a person gets a little bit of cement, they can reinforce their house. So when there is natural weather, climate problems, their house doesn't blow down, the roof doesn't fly off. So you just see it not only in food aid and their ability in agriculture to have mobile insurance payments that make them more secure, but you see it in their ability to start a business or to reinforce their house or to pay their kids' school fees.
So are there any risks to the widespread use of mobile money?
There is.
Okay.
So the first one is that we want to make sure that we're not opening up a new mechanism for money laundering and terrorist financing.
Ah.
So we have to be sure, and the way we do that is we put policies in place, or countries put policies in place, to cap the amount that I can transfer to you and the number. So let's say you're a terrorist. If you got a small amount, maybe $100, but you got it from 1 million people, that would be a problem. Mm-hmm. And so what you need is systems that trigger, much like the credit card fraud algorithms do. And you also need to have just caps on the amount that you and I could transfer.
Are these in place?
So in most countries, they are in place.
What's a typical cap?
A typical cap can be as little as $10, and that's part of the issue of raising it. And what we're trying to do is get for trusted people, like it's the government doing a salary payment, or it's Unilever doing a payment, that it could raise so that we could actually give you a salary. So oftentimes it's $100, and what we need to do is figure out under what circumstances should that be raised to $1,000 or $2,000.
Yeah, because it sounds like you have a saturation problem. So if you've got those limits, then you're not able to have big companies or governments pay real salaries,
exactly.
Right? Exactly. So how far along are you in having this?
Mobile money has been deployed in 84 countries. There's been about 430 million transactions. And so it depends on the country where they are. Generally, most countries are walking before they run. And also, in banking, they do this by what's called KYCs, Know Your Customer. So if you and I are just transferring a buck, then I probably don't need to know much about you and I. If we're transferring $1,000, then the bank or the mobile operator on behalf of the government probably needs to know a little bit more about us.
Okay.
And so part of what it is to develop the regulatory scheme so that you make it really easy to transfer small amounts of money. And in terms of extreme poverty, that's really important. Because people who have extreme poverty, they don't tend to have IDs, they don't tend to have addresses, they don't tend to have utility bills, they don't have the things that are necessary traditionally to open a bank account. So anti-money laundering, terrorist financing is one of them. The next one is consumer protection, so that this isn't fraudulent, so that this is a new thing to keep your PIN confidential.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to also protect or educate consumers that PIN is a sacred code,
right,
that they don't want to tell anybody else. The one thing I love about this technology, particularly for women, is that women have a difficulty holding their own money.
Mm-hmm.
And they often hide it in their underwear or somewhere, but it's very dangerous.
Because their boyfriends or husbands will go spend it on, or brothers will go spend it on something other than family welfare.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the technology companies have allowed you to have multiple PINs for one mobile phone number. So let's say I was married to somebody who was quite abusive and stealing all my money. I could put a little bit of money in that account and show him that's my PIN, but I could have a different PIN where the bulk of my money is that he wouldn't know existed. Now, obviously, if he held a gun to my head and said, do you have another PIN?
Yeah.
That might happen, but that would happen if I was physically.
So this is USAID relying on or working with banks and mobile providers in those countries. Is that correct?
That's right. It also, the Gates Foundation has been a real thought leader in this. And the World Bank has been a real thought leader in trying to get the regulatory stuff right.
And what are we talking about in terms of percent of, I don't know, Africa? Give us some numbers on how prevalent this is now.
There's about 200 million people that have mobile money accounts globally. And about half of that is in sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay.
And so...
So what percent is that of? Do you have any percentages? Is that a minority of people, a small percent of people?
Well, there's about 4.5 billion people that have mobile phones globally.
Mm-hmm.
And so if 200 million of them have mobile money accounts, we've just begun.
Okay.
But here's another example for Africa in particular that's just so exciting, is that... Solar is going gangbusters mm-hmm. in Africa. And the issue is nobody who's poor can afford to buy and pay for installing photovoltaics on their house and in their village. Now, smart technology allows you to pay it per kilowatt hour or per hour of usage.
Oh, interesting.
Mobile money facilitates that significantly. Because I buy kerosene generally, if I'm poor, every day because I can't afford to buy a week's worth. Mm-hmm. Up until now, we haven't been able to buy electricity that way. But now with mobile money, we're able to do that.
And of course, solar being important because it enables countries that don't have that infrastructure and don't have that grid, you know, a village can have its own solar power.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And kids can study at night. People can work by doing piecework in the evening. And so you think about the economic and educational opportunity that extreme poor people are offered by having a light that is enabled by mobile money, it's just tremendous.
So while I have you here, I wanted to step away from that end of the income spectrum and move to the top.
Okay.
And Bitcoin.
Yeah.
What is your, why don't you explain it briefly and tell me your view of it, because there's a lot of controversy about it.
Right, right. So Bitcoin is both a virtual currency, so think about it as a global dollar or euro or peso, but it works a little like the internet. It is also a technology. It's called a blockchain technology. Some people believe it will be more disruptive and more important than the internet itself. But here's the downside risk of Bitcoin. Countries manage, and Jenny Yellen's doing a great job of managing the money supply and flows of money, both within a country and across countries. If you have a virtual currency that has no operation, has no authority like that, you run the risk of having either significant collapses or the issue is who's worrying about money laundering and terrorist financing.
And that's what we've seen stories of money laundering with Bitcoin.
Yes, and it was the big, Silk Road, which was one of the big drug dealers mm-hmm. You bought and sold because you can be anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
I am fundamentally a technologist and believe that you can't stop it. There's some countries that thought, that internet, that just is bad news. We don't want that in countries because you could have Twitter and people could find out exactly what's happening and they could end up in Tahrir Square
yeah.
and want to overthrow a government.
Right.
So the notion that with technology we can just barricade the doors and not let it in, well, history just tells us that doesn't happen.
So you see this coming no matter what.
Exactly. And so the issue is let's be ahead of it. Let's figure out how. So the Treasury Department in our U.S. Treasury in March of 2013 said that anybody that's exchanging digital currencies has to register as money service providers.
Okay.
And so what we want to make sure for Bitcoin or for mobile money, that we don't kill all the innovation
mm-hmm.
that can come out of these innovations in financial services. Think about credit cards and what an advantage that has been. Yes, there's downside. Many of us spend too much on our credit cards, and so it's not that there isn't any downsides. You know, we saw with ISIS, they're using social media, which has been so powerfully good in the world, for a powerfully bad thing.
Right.
And so I think we neither need to just look at Bitcoin as the Darth Vader of the free world
yeah.
and financial services, but we also need to be humbly aware of whether it's anonymous distributed organizations, which is organizations like Al-Qaeda and others, and we need to be ahead of thinking about how do we protect the free, prosperous, healthy world that we cherish so deeply.
I'm glad you raised those terrorist groups. I mean, I should ask, is there evidence that they're using mobile money in any form to finance their operations?
we can assume that they're just like the Hawala system in the Middle East and in Asia. We can assume that terrorists will use any financial system that's available to them. And so the answer is, how do we put safeguards in to have some transparency about it? That's what we really want more than anything. We want to know, where is this mobile money going to? And what I would say to people who want to shut down mobile money because they're worried about terrorist financing, it's a lot more transparent, and we have a digital record of that roadmap of where that money is going versus cash. Cash is the least transparent terrorist financing that exists.
Yeah, that's interesting. So 5 years from now, what is mobile money going to look like? What's the landscape going to look like, whether you're looking at mobile money in places like Africa or Haiti, or whether you're looking here at Google Wallet or Apple Pay, or whether you're looking at Bitcoin? Give us the landscape in 5 years.
I think in the developed world, like the U.S., the U.K., Europe, you'll see it just as another way to pay a bill or to get your money. So it will be nice. It will be fighting for market share with credit cards and direct deposits. I think in the developing world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, where they have very few people that are in the banking system, South Africa has 5%, you will see, you won't see the trajectory like we have at mobile phones. We won't see mobile money have bank accounts everywhere. But I'll give you an example of what's happening in Kenya, because I think that's what's going to happen in the rest of the developing world in 5 years. In 5 years, Kenya has gone from only 25% being in the formal banking system to two-thirds of the country being in the formal banking system.
And that's recent.
Yes. It's from 2007 to 2013. So will the rest of the world go that fast? Not quite, but I think that's what we'll see.
And the impact on poverty?
I think the impact on poverty is going to be significant, but we're not going to be able to measure it in quite the same way. So when you're able to use mobile money to have electricity and your kids now stay in school, we know that if kids in Africa stay in school a year or two longer, it can substantially increase their wages as adults, the piecework that the family will get. So it's not going to be as easy to do the detective work to say, did mobile money that allowed that village to have electricity, is that the real reason they got out of extreme poverty? But I suspect when we look at it, it will come down to fundamental enabling technologies like access to broadband, mobile money, electricity. Those three, I think, will be the pillars of what will change people's lives, the poor, the extreme poor globally.
Well, Mara O'Neill, you've left us a lot of coins for thought. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Remember to follow us on Twitter at Nina Easton and at Smart Women, as well as at CSIS.
Thank you for listening. For more information, go to CSIS.org and subscribe to our podcasts.